So what we want to do this morning is we want to draw out a theme that appears within the Haggadah itself, but also is drilled by Rav Huttner and Pachad Yitzchak, and then it's repeated in different places, a theme that I think comes up in many ways regarding Pesach, but really more generally regarding teaching and regarding interacting with people and sharing lessons with people overall. So let's start from the beginning. One of the unique defining features of the Pesach Seder, if you look in source number one, it's the incessant focus, I think, on questions. Most famously, of course, is the Manashtana, the four questions, or the more popular four questions that we ask during the Seder. But the truth is, that's just one manifestation of an overarching theme and the charge of the night. Again, source number one, the Braisa tells us, Chacham b'no sholo. When it comes to those Manashtana questions, those four questions, so a person who has a child who's able to, so he asks the father, Vim eno chacham, if he's not so. So then ishto shoalto, then if he has his wife ask the questions, Vim lav, if there's no wife to ask the questions, hu shoal atmo. Literally, a person sits there asking himself the questions and answering them. Va'avilu shnei talmidei chacham, even if it's two talmidei chachamim, this with the other guy, sheyodim hilchos pesach, they know all of the dinim of hilchos pesach, still sholim ze lezeh. They still ask each other and give each other the answers. So clearly, there's a focus that the way in which the Haggadah has to be delivered, the way in which Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim has to be performed, is through the derech of sheilos u'tshuvos, of questions and answers, of one person posing a problem and the other person offering a solution. You see that in source number two as well, and the Rambam codifies this halacha, that again, if a person has a son, the son, if not the wife, if not the, he does it himself, if it's two talmidei chacham, they still do it. There have to be questions and answers. But the Rambam really makes it clear that this idea of questions and answers that we're coming onto over here, it's not limited to the Manashtana like we were talking about until now. He introduces within this very halacha the need for shinuyim. If you look in source number two, v'tzarech la'asos shinuy b'layla hazeh. You have to make changes on this night. Kedesha yiru habanim, so that the children will see, v'yishalu, and they will ask, v'yomer manashtana layla hazeh, mikol ha'lilos, they'll ask the questions of Manashtana, and you'll answer, v'yomer lahem, kach v'kach ira, kach v'kach haya. This is what happened. This is what happened in the story of the Yetzias Mitzrayim. V'chetzad mishane. So in what way do we make changes? So I know we make changes. We dip things twice. We lean. All things in the Manashtana, right? But the Rambam says, not only that, we also make other changes on top of what's listed in the Manashtana. Mechalik lahem klayos. Ve'egozim. Ve'okrim ha'sholcham yilafneim kodim shiochlu. V'chot v'matza zem yad zev v'chiyosi b'dvarim elu. We do crazy things. We split up candies and nuts and roasted things to give to the kids. And we take away the table in the middle of the meal randomly so that they don't know what's going on. And we grab matzah from each other. We do all these funny things. Why? So that the children will see and they will ask. And in these cases, we're not even sure what the answer is, correct? Half the time, when the kids ask the question, I use this during the year also, she says, so the children will ask, right? The reason why we did it is so the children will ask. I do that all the time at home during the year. It works. It works for kids at a certain age. You should try it. So this is an important etzah. It's an important piece of advice. It's an important derech, a mahalach, a way of a living when it comes to Talmud Torah in general. Learning can't be a passive endeavor. It can't be that a person sits back and listens to shiurim all the time. They have to be engaged. They have to be involved. There has to be an active engagement in Talmud Torah. That's true really for two main reasons. First of all, a person can't possibly dig deeply and probe the depths of Torah and understand it wholly unless they're involved. They're actively engaged in learning. You have to be able to ask a question. You have to be able to give an answer. You have to be able to think for a second. If all of our learning takes place by listening to Wayu Torah and we're never pressing pause to think about it, or we're never emailing the person who's speaking to ask a question or whatever, so we're losing out on so much of that active engagement with Torah, and it's missing a large chelik of our kinyan, of our acquisition of those divrei Torah. Secondly, Torah always needs a mashpia and a mushpa. Torah needs a giver and a receiver. It needs someone who is influencing and someone who's being influenced. It's a beautiful story. I've told it a lot of times, I don't think here, about the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch was married four different times in his lifetime. Three wives predeceased him. His second wife was the daughter of the Sanzer Rebbe, the sister of Rav Chaim Sanzer. Rav Chaim Sanzer became the Sanzer Rebbe that we're familiar with, the Divrei Chaim. So when they were brothers-in-law at that time, so they were chavrusas as well. They would learn together. So it was going in the beginning, they were learning, and it wasn't going properly. It wasn't going well. They weren't enjoying it. It seemed like it was a bad match. So they tried to figure out what was wrong. So they realized the problem with their chavrusa shaft was that both of them were talmid chacham, both of them were gedolei hador. So each one was just saying questions and answers and giving over a whole shir klali, and the other person was just like, yeah, I could have thought of that question, I could have thought of that answer. No one was giving and no one was receiving. So what they decided, this is unbelievable, this is quoted in a biography of the Minchas Chinuch. I don't know if there's another biography, but there's one tiny, thin one that I once bought at a used farm sale outside of YU, right outside of the pizza store. Couldn't have lunch that day because I bought the Sefer, but it was worth it because it had this story in it. Not so much else, but this story at least. So the way the story goes, they had a meeting to to discuss their chavrusa, and they decided that in order to make it work, they had to play a game. They had to act. Every day they would switch off. One person would play Rebbe and one person would play Talmud. So one person, the Divrei Chaim, would sit back and listen to the shir of Minchas Chinuch, ask questions, try to, you know, pick away at the Dvar Torah, and the Minchas Chinuch would be the Rebbe. And the next day they flip. The Minchas Chinuch would sit back and listen to the Divrei Chaim, and the Divrei Chaim would give the Divrei Torah and he'd ask questions and give answers. Torah needs shelos u'tshuvos. Torah needs a give and take. It needs a teacher, it needs a questioner, it needs an answer, it needs some masu matam, some back and forth. That's a necessary step in Talmud Torah in general. Of course, the ideal form of that active learning takes place between two people, a Rebbe and a Talmud, a Mashpia and a Moshpa. But the truth is, it can happen in other ways as well. There's a famous video of Rav Eliashiv like this online, that when he would learn out loud. The Gemara says you're supposed to learn out loud in general. It's good for memory, but also it's a Chaim Heim Motzeim, Motzeim Bepeh, that it's an important thing to verbalize our Talmud Torah. But Rav Eliashiv used to do it in a way that stood out. So much so that the Rav Lopiansky tells a story that that when Rav Eliashiv was being set up with his wife, so the prospective father, Rav Aryeh Levine, came to meet with him. The way they did is they scheduled a meeting, but everyone knew Rav Eliashiv, everyone knew Rav Aryeh, so they didn't want to meet together in a public place. It would be too obvious, so they set aside some shul that no one really, abandoned shul that no one really went to, and they were going to meet there to talk about the possible shidduch. So when Rav Aryeh Levine got there, he heard a chavrusa learning, and he heard one of them was Rav Eliashiv. And he said to himself, why would he do this? It was supposed to be a private meeting. Why would he bring a chavrusa? So he sit there listening, and then the chavrusa never left. He didn't want to disturb, so he left. He went back, and he told the shachan, we were supposed to meet in private, and Rav Eliashiv brought his chavrusa. And the shachan said, no, you don't understand. Rav Eliashiv learns by himself that way. He learns by himself. He asks a question, gives an answer. He plays both sides. He plays both sides of the chavrusa. He was waiting for you, so he was learning by himself. It just sounds like he was a chavrusa, because he was shol la'atzmo, and then he was meshiv la'atzmo. Like we're talking about at the Seder. On one level, it's true in all of Talmud Torah. There has to be a give and take, a shailos u'tshuvos, a shoel, and a meshiv. That's true even if a person is stuck by themselves when they're learning Torah. There has to be a give and take, and they make it up. They play both sides, like we saw from Rav Eliashiv. But it seems obvious that our halacha here, in source number one and source number two, about the Haggadah, it's something unique to the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's true in general by Talmud Torah, but it's also something unique about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. In fact, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is quoted by his son, his grandson, the Emek Bracha. Everyone quotes this, that he delineated at least four differences between the daily mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, which we do every day, you know, in the Kriyas Shema, and the once yearly nighttime mitzvah of the Seder of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Zechiras, remembering, and Sipur, telling over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. One of the differences that features in that list, other than, again, we were Mascha, Bugnusim, Messiah, B'Shvach, Rabbi Gamliel, Haya Omer, you have to say, and we say Halel. The Rav Chaim said, one of the major differences is that when it comes to Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, there needs to be Sheila Uchuva. There needs to be question and answer. Someone needs to ask, someone needs to answer. Every single day when you lay in Kriyas Shema, you don't ask, and it would be a hefsek. That would ruin your Kriyas Shema. You don't ask questions and give answers. You just say Kriyas Shema, you lay in it. You just say it out. When it comes to Haggadah, when it comes to Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, Sheila Uchuva. You have to ask questions and give answers. Now, that does start, and we notice it most with Manashtana, but it doesn't end with the Manashtana, as we mentioned before. The Rambam here mentions Mechalik Egozim and Klayos, Okermes HaShulchan. We do all these crazy things that are essentially meaningless. They're meaningless. And like I said, the classic refrain is we do this so the children will ask. Okay, on one level, it's a technical point. We want to keep them up, so they should stay engaged until the answers come at the Seder. But it seems like there's something deeper, that we're encouraging questions, even in cases in which there are no answers. So the focus isn't even really Q&A. The focus is just Q. There are questions, even when there are no answers. Why do we go that far? Why are we hyper-focused on inquiries? Why is that part and parcel of the Seder so much? So Rav Huttner actually addresses this question. It's in a Maimer in Pach Yitzchak, Maimer Yud Zayin. He addressed it in the context of a different discussion. If you look in source number three, it's another unique feature of the Haggadah. We mentioned a moment ago, the Mishnah tells us that when we do Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, we have to do it in such a way that it's maschil begnus, umisayim b'shvach, which means that there's a machlokas, Rav and Shmuel, what this means exactly, but we have to start with the negative and end with the positive. Rav and Shmuel have machlokas, what the negative is. Is it the negative of avadim hayinu lefarav b'misrayim, that we used to be avadim teparo, but then vayotzeinu Hashem elokeinu misham? Or is it mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu? Now I have to start by saying, way back, we used to be ovdei avodah zarah. Is it our gnus or the gnus of the sort of the people that they were in a tough spot? Either way, we can't jump to the end of the story. We have to talk about the negative, the gnus, the disparaging parts of the story, and only then can we get to the buildup of the zarah and then the issue of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So, on one level, that's a pragmatic necessity. Meaning, you need to know you were slaves in order to know that you got freedom. You can't be free without slavery. It doesn't make sense to say the story without the beginning. But this explanation certainly doesn't count for, you know, Metchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu, right? You don't need to know about the past history of Avodah Zarah to know that we were slaves and were freed. You could skip that part. And in another sense, you know, we notice that Avodah Hayinu is more fundamental than it is technical. It's not simply we need to know that for the story. We're deliberate, we're intentional, and we discuss the Gnus and we elaborate on it in different places throughout the Haggadah. So there's something going on here, fundamentally, in terms of Maschil B'Gnus, Umesayim B'Shvach. What is it? Why are we doing it in that way? Why does the Haggadah have to be arranged in the way of Gnus and then Shvach? So the Maharal, you look in source number 4, the Maharal answers this in a beautiful way. He explains how in our world, in our experience, the only way to truly appreciate a Geula is through a Galus. Just like the day, you'll look inside of the words over here, just like the day comes after the evening and sunlight is most appreciated as it comes up over the horizon at sunrise after a long dark night. So the same thing is true about redemption, about Geula, about Yeshua. It can only be felt deeply once we've experienced the darkness of the preceding painful exile. Ki ha-shevach shekodem lo gnus yoser shevach. The praise which comes after disparagement, that's a bigger praise. Kimo shetira ki ha-yom kodem lo alayla. Day always comes after night. You can't find completion at the start in our experience. You can't start shalem. You have to build. It's always a process. It always starts with a negative and ends with a positive. There's always something missing that then becomes completed through a Yeshua. We need to be maschil b'gnus in order to understand the shvach of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's a necessary step in the process of geula to go through a galus. So Huttner quotes this Maharal, and then he says that this, in fact, is the key to understanding the format of She'elos U'Tshuvos at the Seder as well. Look in source number 5. Mamshichin anu asakav hala, going from this Maharal, ki ofen ha-sipur shel Yetzias Mitzrayim ba behat'ama l'tochen ha-sipur. Ki keshem she'tochen ha-sipur mechayev l'saper as'inin ha-geula. Dafka b'tur shlema shetzamcha misoch achisaron kemochein ofen hatzipor, but dafka b'toras tshuva al she'ela. Says Rav Huttner so beautifully in this poetic form over here, that the content of the Haggadah is all about this contrast between gnus and shvach, between galus and geula, between challenges and solutions. That's the content of the Haggadah. So just as the content of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is all about these contrasts between light and dark, so too, the construct of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim needs to be in the format of problem and resolution. The format of Shelo Tshuva is the most fitting, most consistent way to discuss the Gnus and the Shvach, the dark and the light, the Galus and the Gula of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, because the story needs to be told in a form which is consistent with the story itself. Challenge and resolution, question and answer. Since we're maschil b'gnus u'masayim b'shvach, because we need to show the contrast between galus and geula, so too we have to tell the story in a form of contrast between problem and resolution. Question and answer is really representative of the theme of the Haggadah as well. The truth is that theme shines through, and this my chavrusa pointed out to me, that theme shines through not only in the content and the construct, as we said before, of the Seder, but also in the conduct, and that definitely could have been the title. Content, construct, and conduct. That's a really YU title. We eat matzah and we eat maror. We eat matzah, we eat maror. We lean and we bemoan the hard labor and the torture of Mitzrayim. It's a confusing night of contradictions. But the point that Rav Huttner is telling us, that is the point. The content, the construct, and the conduct of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim are constantly consistent. They're always in the same vein. They're always on the same page. There is this contrast, Gnus and Shvach, Geula and Tshuva, Geula and Galus, Shela and Tshuva. There's always this contrast between the two of them. It's consistent throughout in our actions, in our tochen, the actual content of the story, and in the way we tell the story as well. It's a beautiful idea that Rav Huttner shares with us. And we take that to the extreme. You know, we take that to the extreme. Not only do we tolerate questions about Yetzias Mitzrayim, about matzah, maror, haseba, the manashtana, but we even encourage petty questions about candies and moving the table, things that have no answer, but they're being asked just for the sake of the questions. It's not even our goal to educate. It's our goal to show the children and the whole family what it means to feel the contrast, what it means to live in that space between galus and geula, what it means to feel the pangs of a good question, because that's where the appreciation for the answer really lies. He has a beautiful line over here. I didn't bold it, but somewhere in source number 5, where he says that any person who engages in real thoughtful line of thinking, real thoughtful line of philosophy, machshava, Talmud Torah, learning in general, someone who's a thoughtful person knows that oftentimes the question is more important than the answer. Not only what people say the question is better than the answer. When you ask a really good question, they give you an answer that's not as good. They say the question is better than the answer. This is even more than that. Sometimes the question is for the reason of the question. Sometimes you ask a question and the answer is not the important part. The important part is that you came onto the question. That's what the Seder night is about. It's about the questions, not so much about the answers. And that's because we're trying to tell a story of Maskel Begnos, to Messiah Mishvach. We're trying to tell a story of contrasts between Galus and Geula, between dark and light. It's a beautiful idea. It underlies and encompasses so much of what we do on Seder night. But it's also incredibly important as a theme in all of teaching and all of the interactions that we have. In fact, it's an idea that Rav Huttner and the Maharal, you look at the source sheet, it's all Rav Huttner's and Maharal's from here. Rav Huttner and the Maharal come back to this theme so many times throughout their writings. I wanted to show you just a few places where we have the same idea come up with a different beautiful Divrei Torah, some of which relate to the Haggadah as well. We'll start with such a gorgeous, gorgeous Divrei Torah that Rav Huttner has in Maimer Ayin Dalid. So, Rav Huttner notes, you look in source number 6, that in the case of each makkah, there was a hasra. There were 10 makkos in Mitzrayim, there was a hasra, there was a warning by Moshe Rabbeinu to Paro before that the makkah came, that you're going to, if you don't listen, you're going to get this plague, and then the plague would come. Let my people go, or else they're going to be hit with the wrath of God by the coming plague. However, there's one exception. Usually, the hasra comes right before the makkah. But the one exception is the following. You'll look here in the psukim, the pasuk in Parshas Shmos, all the way back in Parshas Shmos. Via Marta el Paro, you, says Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu, you, when you encounter Paro, initially, early on, via Marta el Paro, you should say to him, Ko amar Hashem, b'ni b'chor Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael are my b'chor, they are my firstborn, they are my prime creation in the world. Va'omar elecha, I'm saying to you, shalach es b'ni v'yavdeni, send out my son, my b'chor, and he will serve me. Va'tima ein l'shalcho, should you refuse, to send them out, Hine anochi horig es bincha b'chorecha. I am going to kill your b'choros. I am going to destroy your firstborn Paro. The b'choros of Mitzrayim will be killed if you don't send out the Jewish nation, which is my b'chor. What is strange about that hasra, about that warning? What number makkah was b'choros? I don't need you to stick your hands in your coffee and count them out for me, but what was it? The 10th, the very last one, correct? And it's the first warning, all the way in the beginning. Before Moshe even gets there, he's told, you have to warn Paro about the very last makkah, about the makkah at the end of the story. Start with the beginning. Start with Dam, Svardaya. Start with something that's going to be initial. Or start with a general theme. Why are you going all the way to the end, the last makkah, in the very beginning? You hear the question? Before you even get there, that's the first warning you're going to give. So Rav Huttner says something unbelievable. We need a little bit of background. He notes that here, in the pasuk, the Jewish people are referred to as B'ni B'chori Yisrael. You know, then Lashon HaNeviim, Yirmiyah, and elsewhere, the firstborn status of the nation is referred to as Rashis, the initial creation, Rashis, the first, the initial original nation. In fact, Chazal tell us, you know this from Rashi Al HaTorah and Parshas Bereishis, that when the Torah says Bereishis Bara Elokim, the Beis in the Hebrew language can function in really four different ways, the Ramban tells us. But one of the ways is Beis could be Bishvil. So Beis Rashis, Bereishis means Bishvil Rashis, for the purpose of the Rashis. What's the Rashis? So one of the ideas that Chazal say is that B'Rashis, Bara Elokim, as the Shemayim B'Sa'aretz, Bishvil Rashis, Bishvil Yisrael, Shenikra Rashis. The world was created for the Jewish people who were the first creation in the entire world. And yet, that is absolutely not true. The Jewish people were not the first creation. In fact, the Jewish people were the final creation of all the nations. There were 70 nations that existed in the world, 69, and at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jewish people were formed. Through the Korah Barzel, they came together as Shvatim, turning into an Am, turning into a nation, and only once we left Mitzrayim and headed towards Har Sinai did we become a Klal Yisrael, did we become a nation, an Am Yisrael, that exists in the world. So I don't understand. You're saying, Bishvil Rashis Nivra HaOlam. For the Jewish people who are the Rashis, they're the Bechor. You know, the Jewish people are the first of everyone. They're the primary, the original nation. And yet, really, it's not true. Really, they're not even the second. They're the last. They're the last nation of all of them. So apparently, the status of Bechor, the status of firstborn, of Rashis, of Tchila, which inheres in the Jewish people, it's something which is initially, originally, Ole B'machshava. It's the plan of creation. It's an idea in the mind, so to speak, not literally, of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, all the way back to Bereishis, all the way back to the creation of the world, even though that plan's not actually solidified and actualized in a concrete way until much later on, at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. meaning it's a sof maisa b'machshava tchila. It happens last as a manifested entity in this world, but it starts first. It's the rachis, it's the initial, it's the b'chor in thought, in machshava, in the idea and the plan for the entirety of the world. So Rav Huttner explains so amazingly here. Rav Huttner says that the Kedushas HaBechor of the Jewish people was, again, a sof maseb machshava tchila. It was last on the list of things that happened, but first on the list of things that were planned, first on the list of the master grand plan for the entirety of the world, reishis HaMachshava, but last in maisa, sof maseb machshava tchila. It was an intent that was only manifest later on. So too, says Rav Huttner, Moshe Rabbeinu had to deliver the message of Makas Bechoros, which was the place in history where we see the distinction between the Bechor of the Jewish people and the Bechor of the rest of the world, the Bechor of Mitzrayim, that's going to take place later on. In actuality, the concrete physical manifestation of that idea is going to take place later on. The Hasra'a, the warning, takes place right at the beginning. Moshe Rabbeinu says to Paro, you should know now that there's a Bechor in your midst. And if you don't send them out, your Bechor will be wiped out. It's not going to happen for a while. It's not going to happen until the last of the plagues. But the delivery of the message was consistent with the idea, the content, the message was trying to convey. We were trying to teach you about the status of Bechor, of the firstborn status, the original nature of the Jewish people. The way to teach that is by saying all the way in the beginning that this is who they are. This is who you have in your midst. This is who you have to get rid of if you don't want to be, you know, smitten, if you don't want to be killed with your own Bechoros. That won't happen until later on, just like the Bechor of the Jewish people exists in thought, in idea, early on, at the first point of history, but only later on is it actualized physically. Sof maizem machshavat chila. So too, the content is that way. So too, the construct through which we deliver that content, the way that Moshe Rabbeinu is going to deliver that message, is in such a way of sof maizem machshavat chila. This will happen at the end, but I'm telling you right now, there's going to be a makas bechoros. Here, it's the same idea we saw before. The idea a person is trying to give over has to be consistent with the theme. The theme has to be consistent with the mode of transmission. The method by which I convey the material has to be consistent with the material itself. I'm trying to convey a message of sof maisav machshavat chila. If I'm trying to tell you something that's going to happen later, but actually exists already now in machshava, if it's a sof maisav machshavat chila, my hasra, my warning, my speech has to be one which represents the material which is trying to convey as well. Another example, you have in source number, I think it's the first page here, you have it in source number 8. The Pasuk in Parshas Shmos tells us that the Na'aros of Bas Paro, the maidservants of Bas Paro, were walking holchos. So the Gemara in Sotah and Daf Yud Beis understands from here that even though the Pasuk says halicha, it says they were walking, the Gemara understands this to be a veiled reference to the fact that the Na'aros, these maidservants, died. They were mesos, they died. So the Maharal explains that the death over here does not mean a literal death. It doesn't mean they actually died. Look in source number 8, the Maharal in Gvuras Hashem, Perek Zayin, he says, V'na'arosel hochos al yad ha'yor, that's what the Pasuk says, shayu hochos lemisa al shem michuba shalotichach haziyala, they were saying, they were opposing Bas Paro's idea to take Moshe out of the river, and he wasn't going to be saved. So because they were opposing them, HaKadosh Baruch Hu struck them down and killed them. Says the Maharal, it doesn't mean literal death. Misa el Yona. It was a metaphysical death, a spiritual death. Meaning they have certain kochos and mazalos. They have certain spiritual strengths and the like. They have certain help from Shemayim. All of that left them at that moment. When they tried to oppose Bas Paro's saving of Moshe Rabbeinu, they died spiritually. They died spiritually. That's what the Maharal says here. Says the Maharal, that's why the story is not explicated by the psukim. The psukim just say they were walking. They were walking, and we understand from there that they died. So the Maharal says they didn't really die. They died in like a metaphysical sense, not in reality, not in the pshuto shel mikra of the world. They died in the world of drashos. They died in a metaphysical way. They died in another world.
Maybe it was like a freeze frame.
I'm sorry?
They froze.
I don't think so, but I think I was more makas choshech was that way. So the Maharal says that the story is not explicated by the psukim because they didn't die in the realm of pshat. Listen to this. The Maharal says that in real life metzias, they did not die. In the reality of the world, they didn't die. They died in a metaphysical world. They didn't die in the real world. The psukim describe what happens in real life because the psukim are pshat. The psukim are the simple understanding. The simple understanding of what happened is they walked. Because they did walk, and they continued walking. They didn't die on the spot. In the world of drush, in the world of metaphysical, in the world of above and beyond the pshuto shel mikra, outside of the metzias with which we interact, that's where they died. A misa elyona, in a different world. The psukim tell the story of reality. The drushos that Chazal make tell the story of what's happening beyond that reality, what's happening in the upper worlds. says Maharal, the psukim have to represent the world of pshat, and the drushos have to represent the world of drush. If you look in source number 9, the Rav Huttner explains this very Maharal, again, later in Pachad Yitzchak and Pesach, a different piece, in Maimar Nun Beis. So he quotes this Maharal, and he explains that since HaKadosh Baruch Hu was istakel baraisa uvara alma, Ribbono Shel Olam looked into the Torah and created the world based on the Torah, like the Torah, along with the Torah, it coexists with the Torah, so the world, just like the Torah, exists on multiple planes. Pardes, pshat, remez, drash, sod. The world exists on multiple levels. It exists in many ways. That which the Torah reveals to us explicitly, again in source number 9, that which the Torah reveals to us explicitly happen in the realm of pshat. And therefore the psukim convey that. But things which occur in the world of drush, in the world of sod, in worlds outside of the Torah, are not written explicitly in the Torah. Because the content is not pshat. The content is drush. The content is this happened in another world. This happened on another level. This didn't happen in the reality with which we interact. And therefore, the psukim of the Torah can't say it in a literal sense. It can't say that the naros of Bas Paro died. They didn't die in the world of pshat. They died in the world of drush. So the Torah says, holchos, they walked. And Chazal pick up and say, yeah, they walked in real life. But in the realer life of a different world, they were spiritually dead at that moment. They died at Misa El Yonah. Unbelievable. It can't be spelled out by the psukim if it's not something which is literal, which happened in our reality. With that, Rav Huttner actually goes on to explain, it's not on your sheet, but he explains that's the difference between two people we know who didn't die before the year 1994. Two people who didn't die in history of the Jewish people? Well, Eliyahu and Avi and? Pinchas is the next stage of that. Yaakov. We know Yaakov lo meis, the Gemara says. Now here's what's interesting, which might be why you're furrowing your brow, whatever the phrase is. Yaakov lo meis is not a pasuk. In fact, the pasuk says that he died and they did avelus and they mummified him. So Yaakov was pretty dead in the real world and the psukim convey that. However, the Gemara says Yaakov lo meis, that Yaakov never died. Eliyahu Anavi, the pasuk says he didn't die. The psukim say he was walking along with his student and all of a sudden a fiery chariot came and took him up to Shemayim. So the Maharal, Rav Huttner says, the difference is that Yaakov literally died. Therefore, the psukim say he died. However, in the realm of metaphysicality, in the realm of drush, he lived forever. His message, his meaning, his purpose, his values lived on forever. Yaakov lo meis, his effect is ongoing for all eternity. In reality, he died, so the psukim can't say that, but the chazal can come along and say, but there's hints to the fact that he carries on, that he still goes. Eliyahu Anavi didn't die in real life. And therefore, the psukim actually explicate it. Because the means of teaching this idea is coming through the psukim. That shows that it happened in reality. Whereas by Yaakov Avinu, it's something that didn't actually happen in reality, but it happened in a plane above and beyond our reality. So it couldn't be in the psukim. It had to be on the level of drush. Unbelievable. I have my personal Rebbe in Maharal and in Pachad Yitzchak. His name is Rabbi Avram Alter. He's a big Tam Chacham who lives in Riverdale. So he told me at the time that this is another expression of our same Yisod, that something which occurred in the world of Pshat has to be given over in the Torah of Pshat. Something which occurred in the realm of Drush has to be given over in the realm of Drush. The language we use to teach a message has to be consistent with the message itself. The same way that we have to have back and forth Shailos Teshuvos at the Seder. The same way that we have to have, you know, the Gnus and the Shvach, that the content of Gnus and Shvach has to result in a means and a method of talking in Shailos Teshuvos. The same way that Makas Bechoros had to be taught about with an initial thought and an action at the end, because that's what it is. The Kedushas Bechor of the Jewish people is initially a thought and only comes into fruition at the end. So that's all consistent. The way we talk has to be consistent with the theme we're trying to give across. That's true here too, that when the Naros of Bas Paro die, it's told in the realm of Drush because it didn't happen in the real world. When something happens in Pshat, it has to be said in the Torah of Pshat because again, the construct through which we teach has to be consistent with the content which we are teaching. You look in source number 10, Rav Huttner, in fact, introduces his entire sefer. The Ha'ara Klalus is the beginning of every sefer where he introduces what he's trying to do in Pachad Yitzchak. So he introduces the entire concept of his mahalich, of giving over this unique Torah of Pachad Yitzchak with this idea. So he spends time fleshing out the difference between learning halacha and learning deos and chovos levavos, we call machshav and musar. The root of the learning is the same, he says, but the destination is different in that we're impacting and affecting, I guess, emotions and feelings and our nefesh, as opposed to halacha, where we're implementing certain actions. So here, Rav Huttner says, look in source number 10, Hargashas blita zo, understanding this difference, hiago remeslanu, it's what causes us, here's the important line, sheniyachid es hadibur ve'es ofen hadibur, es halimud ve'es ofen halimud, But also chelak haTorah hashayech lechovos hamitzvah. Says Rav Huttner, if I'm teaching you something that is qualitatively different, it's machshava, it's Torah of the nefesh, Torah of the heart, as opposed to Torah of the arms and the legs and the ma'isa mitzvahs that we do when we learn halacha, then you better believe that the ofen haTorah, the dibor is different, the ofen haDibor has to be different. The limud is different, the ofen haLimud is different. The way in which we're going to give it over is going to change based on what we are giving over. I think that Avram Alter at the time pointed out that part of this is responding people question Rav Huttner because the way he gave, you know, classic yeshivas, you give a shir, you give a shmooze, the Rebbe stands up, he teaches, he yells, he jumps, whatever, and people ask questions afterwards. It's very formal. But the way that Rav Huttner would give over these shmooze was around the table. It was like a tish sort of setting. It wasn't a chassidish place, but it was like a tish sort of setting. On Purim, he'd have music and a 10-piece band while he was giving these shmooze. The language was different. It was more flowery. The things he was talking about were obviously different. And the way in which he gave it over and the aura and the atmosphere of what was going on around was totally different. So why are you doing things different? Why are you changing the way that we give over a Torah? Rav Huttner says, I'm not. I'm just giving over a different Torah. If I'm giving over a different content, then it has to be a different format. It has to be a different forum. It has to be entirely different method of transmission if I'm giving over a different message. That's what Rav Huttner is saying in his Sahara as well, that all of his Torah really represents that. There's two mashalim, I think, that capture this, you know, in light. First of all, imagine a person giving a hesped. So we'll use an extreme, you know, humorous example. Imagine a person giving a hesped, and they open with a joke, and they're smiling the whole time, and they're saying over things about the mace, about the person who passed away, but it's all leitzanus, it's all jokes. So it's not only uncomfortable, it's also uncomfortable. But even if the content is good, and they're saying nice things about the person who passed away, the transmission is so off base. It's so ridiculous, it's so incongruous with what he's trying to deliver, that it doesn't land. No one appreciates what the guy's trying to say because he's laughing throughout his hesped, throughout his eulogy. It makes no sense to say it over that way. You know, it's true even if it's not an extreme example like that. If a person, a rav, gets up to give a hesped, and instead of, you know, saying a nice, meaningful Dvar Torah in a somber, monotonous voice, he gets really into it and starts saying over lamdas, and he has a kasha in the Rambam, because they say that, I heard the story from Ramati Kamenetsky a few years ago, that Ramati Kamenetsky is the Rosh Shiva at South Shore in Five Towns. So he said that they say, he heard it from a telzer. I haven't seen it in writing, but he heard it from a telzer, that the telzer, Reb Lazer Telzer, Blazer Gordon. So he was, his wife passed away, and he was maspid his wife. He was standing up giving a eulogy for his wife. And as he gave the eulogy, he was giving it over, and then he had a kasha, and he said over a Rambam, said the kasha, the question. And as he came around to giving an answer, he was like pumping his fists, he was getting into the answer, and all of a sudden he gives the answer to the Rambam, and he gets so into it, and he says, gold in der Welt! It's like gold in the world. This pshat in the Rambam is gold. And it was like, whoa, we're in the middle of a hesped, you know, like, what, that was a little incongruous. So again, it becomes, okay, so you're giving over a Rambam at the wrong time, right? It becomes like a funny thing. It doesn't match what you're trying to give over. The mode with which you give it over has to match the content which you're trying to tell over. Medicine is, the content of medicine, the ingredients of medicine is what heals you. But there's also, this is important for Hilchos Pesach, there's also a delivery medium, right? There's something in which the medicine is encased or not encased in order that it should get to the right part of your body in the right time in the right way. If a person ingests topical medicine, it's either pyrev or harmful to the person, right? And if a person swallows a medicine that's not properly encased, it's not good either, even though it's the same medicine that's supposed to go to the bloodstream, but it doesn't get to the bloodstream. It gets stuck in a different area of the body or dissolves before it gets to the place it's supposed to go, or again, worse. You need the content, but the content has to be delivered with the proper medium. If a person says things in a way that's inconsistent with what they're trying to say, you lose the effect of what you're trying to give over. You have this in another place in the Maharal as well, in source number 11. This is amazing. The Maharal tells us, you know, we know that that Chazal tell us that Vayisiatzu Tachta Zahar, that Klal Yisrael stood under the mountain, means literally under the mountain. Why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Kafa Aleim Har Kegiges. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held the mountain over our heads and said, if you accept the Torah, great. If not, Shom Tei Kruaschem. You're going to die right here. The mountain's going to fall on your head. You're going to be buried right here. So everyone asked the Kasha. The Taisa asked the Kasha. What do you mean? We said, Naaseh V'Nishma. We accept the Torah willfully, voluntarily. We opted in. So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu force it? So Tosfos gives an answer. The Maharal rejects the answer. The Maharal says his own answer. Unbelievable. This is very classic Maharal. Beautiful idea. In source number 11, I'm not going to read inside, but you'll see it's in the Gurari and the Parsha, and it's also in Tiferes Yisrael. The Maharal suggests that no. The truth is that the kfiya, the forcing of Har Kegiges over our heads, was something which bespeaks the nature of Talmud Torah. It's true we opted in. It's true we volunteered. It's true we said Naaseh V'Nishma. But Torah is not optional. Torah is necessary. Torah is mandated. So much so, not only that we can't opt out if we don't want to do mitzvos, but so much so the world will return to tohu vavohu. The world will cease to exist if we don't have Torah. If Torah does not exist, the world doesn't exist. Torah is absolutely necessary. Torah is by force. It's hechrechi. It's absolutely necessary and fundamental and critical to the existence of us and to the existence of the entire world. It's very nice that we said Naaseh v'nishma. But once we accepted the Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to give it to us in a way that was by force. In a way that was the mountain over our heads. In a way that was Sham Tei Kurastam. Because even though the content was accepted willfully, voluntarily, we had to be shown through the context, through the construct, through the way, the method, the mode in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah, that don't think for a second this is optional. You have to realize this is absolutely necessary. This is critical. This is fundamental. This is the core of the world. So we held a mountain over our heads and said, this is what Torah is. And the way he gave us the Torah bespeaks the nature, the character of the Torah itself. Again, this idea that the way we transmit the idea has to be consistent with the idea itself. It's a fascinating medrash in Parshas Yisro. The medrash Tanchuma says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah, this is like hard to understand exactly, but he had different faces on for different parts of the Torah. So whatever, when he gave over the Mikra, he had panim ze'umos. When he gave over the Mishnah, he had panim sofkos. When he gave over the each of the panim, he had panim beinonios for Mishnah and panim, I don't know, other ones, whatever. So he had different faces on for each type. Sukkim and Mishnah and Gemara, Agadata, each one had a different face. And then HaKadosh Baruch had to say that Anochi Hashem Elokecha, we shouldn't think there's so many gods. There's one God, even though there's a lot of faces, so to speak. What is going on over here with these kiviyachol different expressions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So I think the idea is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to show us that each area of Torah demands a different way of transmission. Each area of Torah demands a different look on the Rebbe's face, a different joke, a different story, a different way of putting the things together, a different order of expression, a band or not a band, a tish setting or a shir setting, a shtender or not a shtender. Each type of shir needs a different method. The dibor has to be consistent with the ofen adibor. The construct needs to match the content. And that's the theme that we've been developing until now. That's true in the Medrash as well about HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself at Har Sinai, the way he taught us the Torah. So we began with the Haggadah. The teaching of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim needs to be in a format of She'elo Tshuva. That's again because the construct needs to be consistent with the content, as we've said so many times now. What we see is that it's not limited to Haggadah. It's an idea we learn in the Haggadah. It's an idea we see expressed there in She'elo Tshuvos, there in Makas Pachoros, but it expands. It goes elsewhere. It goes to all of teaching, all of Limud HaTorah, from Matan Torah itself, from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the Psukim and the Drushos, like the Maharal told us about the Na'aros of Bas Paro, to a teacher or a parent who's giving over a student, a child, a Divrei Torah. We need the method to be consistent with the material. But you have to realize that students, children, our families, our friends, they're constantly learning from everyone all around them. Children in particular are this way, but all human beings are like this. It's not just the messaging when you're giving a Dvar Torah at the table, when you're speaking in shul, when you're speaking at a simcha, that has to be consistent with the way you give it over. You're engaging in Dvar Torah, so you have to say it in the proper way. The idea of practicing what you preach is a very fundamental idea. Our actions in general have to be consistent with the message we're trying to give over to our children. If we're trying to be a light, a beacon of Torah values, of good morals, of ethics, of being good human beings to our children, then unless our method, our mode of conduct, the way we act, is consistent with that content, the message won't work. It'll be like laughing during a eulogy. It'll be like swallowing a topical ointment. It won't work. You can say it all you want. You can tell them the message all you want. But unless we live the message, unless we practice what we're preaching to our children, to our families, it's not going to land. It needs to be consistent. The ofen hadibor needs to match the dibor itself. The ofen halimud has to match the limud itself as well. Children and students, they need to see us as the fitting kli, the receptacle, the actual vehicle through which the Torah is disseminated. It has its laws, its values are coming through us, and therefore we have to bespeak, we have to represent those laws and those values. We need to take that message of She'elos U'Tshuvos, of Maskel B'Gnos, of Messiah B'Shvach, of being consistent in the way we talk with what we're trying to get across, and we have to apply that to every single area of teaching and really every single area of interaction with people in general. So I wish us all a wonderful Pesach. We're not going to get together until afterwards, obviously. But B'siyat Hashmai, we should have a nice starim with our families around us, with our friends around us, and we should be able to give over messages that are livable, that are meaningful, and we should give them over in a way that they actually land, they actually register, and make a difference in the people around us.